Chairman, as all of you know, we have been involved in an intensive effort to end the conflict in Kosovo for many weeks now. Today, the peace talks were adjourned because the Serbian negotiators refused even to discuss key elements of the peace plan. NATO has warned President Milosevic to end his intransigence and repression or face military action. Our allies are strongly united behind this course. We are prepared, and so are they, to carry it out. Now, roughly 40,000 Serbian troops and police are massing in and around Kosovo. Our firmness is the only thing standing between them and countless more villages like Rakak, full of people without protection, even though they have now chosen peace. Make no mistake, if we and our allies do not have the will to act, there will be more massacres. In dealing with aggressors in the Balkans, hesitation is a license to kill. But action and resolve can stop armies and save lives. We must also understand our stake in peace in the Balkans and in Kosovo. This is a humanitarian crisis, but it is much more. This is a conflict with no natural boundaries. It threatens our national interests. If it continues, it will push refugees across borders and draw in neighboring countries. It will undermine the credibility of NATO, on which stability in Europe and our own credibility depend. It will likely reignite the historical animosities, including those that could embrace Albania, Macedonia, Greece, even Turkey. These divisions still have the potential to make the next century a truly violent one for that part of the world that straddles Europe, Asia, and the Middle East. Unquestionably, there are risks in military action if that becomes necessary. U.S. and other NATO pilots will be in harm's way. The Serbs have a strong air defense system, but we must weigh those risks against the risks of inaction. If we don't act, the war will spread. If it spreads, we will not be able to contain it without far greater risk and cost. I believe the real challenge of our foreign policy today is to deal with problems before they do permanent harm to our vital interests. That is what we must do in Kosovo.
As you mentioned, Yugoslav forces seem to be mobilizing for war in Kosovo despite the warnings of NATO airstrikes. After so many threats in the past, why should President Milosevic take this one seriously? And is there a deadline for him to comply? And is it your intention to keep pounding Serb targets until he agrees to your peace terms?
I think he should take this seriously because we meant we were serious in Bosnia. And it was the combined impact of NATO's action in Bosnia, plus the reversals they sustained on the ground in fighting, plus the economic embargo, that led them to conclude that peace was the better course. Now, he says here that this is not like what happened last fall, that this threatens Serbia's sovereignty to have a multinational force on the ground in Kosovo. But he has put that at risk by his decade, and I want to reemphasize that, his decade of denial of the autonomy to which the Kosovars are legally entitled as a part of Serbia. Helen.
President, how long have you known that the Chinese were stealing our nuclear secrets? Is there any trust left between the two nations? And some Republicans are saying that you deliberately suppressed the information from the American people because of the election and your trade goals.
Now, I think there are two questions here that are related but ought to be kept separate. One is, was there a breach of security in the mid-80s? If so, did it result in espionage? That has not been fully resolved, at least as of my latest briefing. The second is, once the executive branch was notified and the investigations began, was everything done in a timely fashion? I am confident that we in the White House have done what we could to be aggressive about this. Look, if there was espionage against the United States, I will be very upset about it, as I have been every time there has been. And anybody who committed it ought to be punished, just as we went after Mr. Ames, anybody else who committed espionage against the United States. Now, the third question is, what, if anything, does this mean about our relationship with China? I don't believe that we should ever afford we can afford to be under any illusions about our relationship with China or any other country, for that matter, with whom we have both common interests and deep disagreements. I believe the course I have followed with China is the one that's best for America. Disagreeing where we have serious disagreements, pursuing our common interests where I thought it was in the interest of the United States. But I can say categorically that it never crossed my mind that I should not disclose some inquiry being undertaken by the United States government for reasons of commercial or other gain. That is not true. I just think we should always pursue what is in the interest of the United States. And if we think we've got a security problem, we ought to fix it. Plainly, the security was too lax for years and years and years at the labs. And a lot of important changes have been made, and yesterday the Secretary of Energy announced some others. I think that if anybody did, in fact, commit espionage, it is a bad thing, and we should take appropriate action. But in our dealings with China, we should do, quite simply, what is in the interest of the American people, and that's what I intend to do.
Mr. President, there's been a lot of people in New York State who've spoken with your wife who seem to be pretty much convinced she wants to run for the Senate seat next year. A, how do you feel about that? Do you think she would be a good senator? And as part of a broader question involving what has happened over the past year, how are the two of you doing in trying to strengthen your relationship, given everything you and she have been through over this past year?
Well, on the second question, I think we're working hard. We love each other very much, and we're working at it. On the first question, I don't have any doubt that she would be a magnificent senator. She told me, over a year ago, and long before this ever occurred to anybody, long before we even knew Senator Moynihan wouldn't run for re-election, that she thought we should move to New York when I left the White House, knowing that I would spend a lot of time at home in my library and with the work there, but that we would also establish a home in New York. I don't have any doubt that she really would be a terrific senator. She knows so much about public policy. She cares so much about the issues, especially those that have a particular impact on New York, including the education and economic issues that would be very important to the people there. But I also have to tell you, the people she's talking to must know more than I do, because I literally don't have a clue. If you asked me today whether I thought it was more likely or not that she would run or not run, I could not give you an answer. I just don't know.
Mr. President, when Juanita Broderick leveled her charges against you of rape in a nationally televised interview, your attorney, David Kendall, issued a statement denying them. But shouldn't you speak directly on this matter and reassure the public? And if they are not true, can you tell us what your relationship with Ms. Broderick was, if any?
Well, 5 weeks ago today, I stood in the Rose Garden after the Senate voted, and I told you that I thought I owed it to the American people to give them 100% of my time and to focus on their business, and that I would leave it to others to decide whether they would follow that lead. And that is why I have decided, as soon as that vote was over, that I would allow all future questions to be answered by my attorneys. And I think I made the right decision. I hope you can understand it. I think the American people do understand it and support it. And I think it was the right decision.
Sir, George Stephanopoulos has written a book that contains some tough and fairly personal criticism of you. Earlier, Dick Morris had written a somewhat similar book. How much pain do these judgments by former aides cause you? And do you consider it a betrayal for people to write books on the history of your administration while you're still in office?
I haven't read either one of the books, but or even any articles about it. I don't think that furthers the commitment I made to the American people to focus on their business and their future. What I will say is that I very much value the loyalty and service I have received from the overwhelming majority of the people who have worked here in the White House and in the cabinet and the administration, often under positions of almost unprecedented pressure. And I think that very often that kind of loyalty goes unrecognized, but it is not unappreciated by me.
Mr. President, many young Americans learn the importance of telling the truth based on an allegory about our very first president. George Washington reportedly said, "I cannot tell a lie." What do you think your legacy will be about lying? And how important do you think it is to tell the truth, especially under oath?
I think it's very important, and I think that what young people will learn from my experience is that even presidents have to do that, and that there are consequences when you don't. But I also think that there will be a box score, and there will be that one negative, and then there will be the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times when the record will show that I did not abuse my authority as president, that I was truthful with the American people, and scores of allegations were made against me and widely publicized without any regard to whether they were true or not. Most of them have already been actually proved false. And it's very hard to disprove every false allegation against you. But we have had more success, frankly, than I was afraid we would when we started. So I would hope that there would be a higher regard for truth-telling by all people in public life and all those who report on it. I think it would be a very good thing.